Hello, my name's Dave Emery, and in the next two half-hour segments, we are going to be visiting once again with Dr. Nick Begich, the author of Angels Don't Play This Harp, who is going to be discontinuing his research on the HARP project. We're going to review some of the information on HARP. However, I thought before I would do that, I would read you not only Nick Begich's formal farewell vis-a-vis HARP, but also some rather disturbing information about the untimely and somewhat strange death of one of his key supporters and close friends. This is an open letter to the Nick Begich's HARP supporters. It's dated November 17th of 1998, and it reads as follows. I ran into the HARP project story quite by accident in 1994. At the encouragement of my friends Gail and Patrick Flanagan, I wrote the first significant article on HARP and co-authored a book about the technology with Gene Manning, Angels Don't Play This HARP. That story led to research in non-lethal weapons, electromagnetic systems, environmental weapons, new types of biological weapons, and related technologies. For 4 years, my wife, children, a few close friends, and I processed tens of thousands of inquiries related to these subjects, wrote and responded to interviews for hundreds of publications, were aired on thousands of radio programs, and gave lectures on the subjects in 20 states and 20 countries. By 1995, I had left my position with the Anchorage School District in order to keep up with the demands of the HARP story. By the end of 1995, we had begun to move back into other areas of interest to us, yet HARP continued to pull large amounts of time and energy. Since that time, we have allowed HARP-related work to dominate much of our time at the expense of other work. We felt that the subject needed this level of commitment in order to reach a high level of public and political debate. As an author and publisher, I realize that the freedom of the press means more than the right to print what it wants to print. It has more to do with the idea of maintaining an informed population through open public debate and discourse, particularly on topics related to public policy. We built a significant database of research materials on weapon systems, which we disseminated around the world to news organizations, elected officials, and scientists. I had an interesting, and in some ways an unsettling, past few months. I was in Brussels in early October reviewing some draft resolutions of the European Parliament in opposition to HARP, certain non-lethal technologies, and new electromagnetic weapon technology which can debilitate human health. While finishing this work, I received word of the death of one of my dearest friends, Gail Flanagan, who was in large part the inspiration for the book Angels Don't Play This HARP. Gail spoke with my wife often in the days before she died and strongly encouraged me to withdraw from the HARP debate and leave it to others to resolve the issue. There comes a time when others who hold positions and citizens generally have to decide if the issue is important enough to take action on. While in Europe, I was informed that the U.S. State Department had sent someone there after my testimony in the Security and Disarmament Subcommittee of the European Parliament's Foreign Affairs Committee. This was a hearing in early February, which NATO refused to attend and debate the issues when asked by the chairman of the committee to provide information. The State Department official spent some weeks in Brussels, but was unsuccessful in dissuading our supporters, who now have extensive documents on these matters. Presently, the inevitable is happening here in Alaska. The military, in cooperation with our congressional delegation, has begun the process of locating and funding a new ICBM defense system here in Alaska. The project is to be funded at $11.4 billion, U.S. dollars. In addition, a number of other related installations are being expanded and funded here. We have continued to reinvest all of our organization's revenues into expanding our work and increasing the scope of our activities in the belief that an activist media organization like ours is needed. As a family and small organization, we are limited in what we can do. As an activist publisher, we have to balance our time commitments in order to continue to bring forward leading information in many areas of science, technology, and politics. I have attached some excerpts of recent communications to further clarify our position in these matters. I personally want to thank you for your interest and help in bringing these issues forward. We appreciate your support on the HARP problem and ask that you stay in touch with us through our publishing and communication efforts on this and other important subjects of Earth Pulse. And later on, Nick provides further information about the death of Gail Flanagan. Gail Flanagan was one of the two people who motivated me to rise out of my station in life and pursue the truth and actualize the change. Without her continued and sustained encouragement, the story of HARP, non-lethals, and now the multifaceted work we are involved in may well have never been started, the truth never told, the information never collected or communicated. In the days before her death, and while I was in Europe, she was speaking to my wife Sheila 4 or 5 times a day by phone. The circumstances and conversational detail are too much for this note and unnecessary now. However, with each call, she issued a loving warning about my work right now, my priorities, and greater purpose in life as a communicator and originator of ideas. As Patrick and Gail's staff went through her things, there was much written caution given. And again, Gail Flanagan died suddenly and unexpectedly at the age of 48 of causes as yet to be precisely determined, and I don't feel particularly comfortable with that death. That, again, an open letter by Dr. Nick Begich to the people who've supported him on the project, on the Heart Project research, and I thought I would read that to you. What we're going to do next is to join Dr. Begich live, and we're going to review some of the information about TARP and some of the things that have taken place since that time. And it's my pleasure once again to present to you Dr. Nick Begich, the author, along with Gene Manning, of Angels Don't Play This Harp, published in softcover by the Earth Pulse Press, copyright 1995. Dr. Begich, welcome once again to our airwaves, and perhaps for the last time on this subject.
Well, thanks for having me back. It's good to be back with you again.
Let me state on behalf of not only the listeners to this program on the various stations that carry it, but also, and this might sound a little corny, on behalf of the human race, let me thank you for your work on Project HARP, and I think it is unlikely that the human species will be able to adequately repay you for your investment and sacrifice. So thanks from the bottom of my heart, and I think I speak on behalf of the audience and an awful lot of other people as well.
Well, I appreciate that, and it's been, you know, it's been an interesting last 4 years, and I think we've accomplished, you know, pretty much what we set out to do, and I think at this point it's really time to move into some other areas that are of equal importance, and, you know, the time is now, I think, and we've really done what we can do on that particular issue, I think, as a small group of people.
Now, I read a little bit about the passing of your dear friend and co-worker, and to a certain extent, I guess, inspirational source, Gail Flanagan. You mentioned that she had gently and, in your words, lovingly warned that it was time to move on to other projects. I was disturbed to hear that she obviously was concerned in this regard, and I was disturbed to hear about her death. What can you tell us concerning the circumstances of her passing?
Well, you know, as far as we know at this point, it's natural causes, although, you know, there's always questions, at least there is in our minds, that maybe there was something else, you know, something else there. But I think it was, you know, natural causes as far as we know. But from my perspective, one of the last things that Gail was, you know, speaking to my wife and I about was the idea that it really was time to move on, you know, some of the other areas that we were interested in. And she was, to a large extent, the inspiration. I mean, her and her husband, Patrick, were the motivators to get me to start to consider writing as a way of telling this story, as opposed to, you know, by just radio or some other means. They really were a big part of our work.
And she was, as I recall from an off-air conversation, 48 years old?
Right.
And she had been in good health?
Oh, absolutely. There was, you know, she was in excellent health. In fact, people often commented on her vitality and just her whole energetic nature.
And so. As I recall, too, you said that apparently, at least as far as they can tell, there had been some sort of rupture in her intestine, which then led to massive toxicity and peritonitis?
Yes, that's correct.
And I don't want to appear overly alarmist, but one of the things that's, in fact, this even looms in the background of some of the HARP technologies. Having studied political assassination and the technology of covert operations, in the year of our Lord, 1999, when a sophisticated agency wants to commit an assassination, they can do it in such a way as neither the person who did it or even how it was done can be properly traced. So sophisticated are the technologies. And this is, again, not to be alarmist about the death of Gail, but killing people in such a way as to make it appear to be natural causes has been a priority of our intelligence services and other countries for a long, long time. And there are numerous Freedom of Information Act documents that attest to that. This is not a point I want to linger on past a point, but I think that the work that Gail did in inspiring you deserves to be commemorated. And I think whenever we lose someone in the political field, I do think that the questions should be asked. I don't pretend to have the answers. An interesting detail concerning your own background, Dr. Begich, and I came to the political dance, so to speak, by looking into the assassination of President Kennedy.
Right.
And your father was a congressman from Alaska who perished in the same plane crash that killed Congressman Hale Boggs of Louisiana, who had not only been a member of the Warren Commission, but at the time that the plane went down, He was openly questioning the Warren Commission's findings, expressed his view that the commission had been lied to by the CIA and FBI, and he was also among the very first to expose the COINTELPRO program as well. And go ahead.
He was, very much involved in, a lot of the mainstream opposition, I guess, to the established structure of government in many ways, and was raising questions that other congressmen certainly weren't raising at the time. And I even called at one point for the resignation of J. Edgar Hoover just 6 or 7 months before the plane flew out of Alaska. But there are lots of things that have come out in the record since that time that indicate, even that may not have been an accident, or certainly the recovery of the plane could have been executed and perhaps wasn't.
Yeah, and again, this is... I don't want to appear overly alarmist about Gail's death, but I myself had been concerned because of the work that you've done. It's not only important, but the military has actually attacked your work on a website, and beyond that, as your letter indicated, and as we discussed in our last interview, you have been instrumental in bringing this project to the forefront of action by the European Parliament.
That's correct. In fact, the last hearing we had in Europe was last February in 98, and that hearing, we were supposed to debate NATO. NATO declined to appear on the basis they said they had no policy on ionosphere commodification, and they had no policy on non-lethal weapons, and we took with us documents. One was a NATO document on ionosphere commodification for weapons application, and the other was a Strategic Studies Institute a report on NATO deployment of non-lethal weapons in a number of conflicts around the world. And really, that hearing was the hearing that focused the attention on not just what HAARP was capable of, but what other weapon systems, in conjunction with HAARP or other facilities, in terms of state-of-the-art science and manipulating human behavior, human health, just the whole specter of electromagnetic weaponry as a concept was what was presented within the context of that hearing.
Let's go to Project HAARP itself, and this will be by way of review for the listeners who have heard the other interviews that we've done. By the way, Angels Don't Play This HAARP is still in print, is it not?
Yes, it is.
Subtitled Advances in Tesla Technology, and I also want to remind listeners that there are four previous interviews with Dr. Begich that are available from Spitfire. Time permitting, I'll give the address, et cetera, at the end of the program. HAARP is spelled with two A's, H-A-A-R-P, standing for, Dr. Begich?
A High Frequency Active Auroral Research Project, and it was essentially a joint effort of the Air Force and Navy, and it's a developmental prototype to test a number of ground-based Star Wars weapons technologies.
Among other things. Now, one of the points that you make in your book is that this is being touted, this system, as an RMA, a revolution in military affairs. It could sort of be thought of as a shopping mall approach to strategic weaponry, and that an awful lot of different capabilities are wrapped up in this system. Now, this system involves using antenna arrays to beam electromagnetic radiation into the atmosphere.
That is correct. And what happens then is by manipulating that energy in various ways, you can create a number of weapons effects. For instance, you can get an over-the-horizon radar effect where you can look around the curvature of the Earth for incoming objects. You can use the same system for discriminating, determining which of those objects carry nuclear payloads and which are decoys. And even at higher energy levels, you can actually control an electromagnetic pulse, which will disable those incoming craft. Or you can use it for communication purposes with submarines by modulating or vibrating the energy at a certain frequency. It creates a long wave that penetrates the Earth and sea for communication with submarines, also for Earth-penetrating tomography, which is in the vernacular, be like X-raying or looking into the Earth several kilometers deep. And in those same frequency ranges are the ranges that we're concerned about that have a direct effect on human physiology by way of entraining body rhythms, brain rhythms in particular, in such a way as to manipulate body chemistry.
We'll get to that in somewhat more detail a little later on in the interview, but one of the most significant, and to many people one of the more alarming aspects of the HAARP capabilities, actually explicitly stated in the patents, if I'm not correct, is that the project is going to be used to alter the weather for military purposes.
Right. In fact, what's interesting about that is since publication of the book, there's been the release of a number of documents on weather warfare. In fact, there was one Space 2525 that dealt with this whole issue of weather manipulation as the ultimate weapon of war. At the same time, you've got people talking about climate manipulation by electromagnetic means, including Secretary of Defense Cohen and others. And this concept of weather war is becoming more interesting to military planners, but at the same time has huge potential for very high risk in terms of unanticipated effects.
Another of the capabilities of the system appears to be the possibility of altering the brainwave patterns of entire population groups.
Yeah, in terms of that particular application, you can go back to the work of J.F. Gordon McDonald, who was a geophysicist and a science advisor to Johnson. And at that time, they were talking about creating a pulse, an electromagnetic pulse that would cause the ionosphere to vibrate and return a signal in the right frequency range to create a behavior modification over a large population. Well, this is exactly what HARP can do when it modulates the ionospheres. It creates just such a long wave in exactly those frequency ranges that correlate to predominant brainwave frequencies in human beings.
Another capability is something called cyclotronic resonance, and this is a phenomenon in which electromagnetic radiation can be used to alter the body chemistry of individuals or population groups on the ground with potentially lethal effect.
Yeah, and this is the idea that you're resonating an energy in at the same frequency as a chemical that's already present in the body. For instance, the iodine is present in the body in some quantity. An excess of iodine creates a toxic effect, but if you resonate energy in at the same frequency as that iodine that's in place, it creates an effect where the body reacts as if it had received a toxic dose of the chemical, and consequently you have lots of symptoms but not necessarily a chemically deduced cause. In other words, if you took blood work, you wouldn't see an increase of iodine, but you'd see the symptoms of it.
That again, and this is not to be alarmist about Gail's death, but with technologies of that type in existence, I think when a good person and a political person passes unexpectedly, I do think it's more important than this culture has recognized to ask questions.
Yeah, I think that's true, but at the same time, you know, in many instances, I think that the approach should be as, you know, however it happens that a person leaves, it's still no reason to not carry on work in a specific way, but it's a recognition point of saying, all right, did we do what we set out to do, and where is it at this point?
Oh, precisely. This is not meant to in any way deter people, but I have been very disturbed for a long time at the lack of awareness on the part of people in this culture, in particular people in the so-called progressive sector, that political assassination in America is a reality, and this is something that cannot... It should not deter one from activity. If anything, it should spur one to activity. Yet at the same time, as Mrs. Lohman said in The Death of the Salesman, attention must be paid.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's perhaps the big caution point in all of this is, you know, when a society isn't paying attention to the issues that are in front of it, is where the setting for this kind of nonsense can actually take place, from my perspective at least. And I think there's, at this point, the good news is I think there's a lot of people in the course of our work that we've met that are in a position to make a difference and that are prepared to take on these kinds of issues. And I think that's, in the long run, really where these things will gradually change. It's just going to be in a political context, but one that's more guided by other interests. Perhaps the whole concept, and this I think is the case, is the Internet and the communications capability of people globally now. Human beings like you and me can talk over thousands of miles to thousands of others. And that possibility didn't exist so much not too many years ago. And yet it's a new democratization, if you will, of political processes. And for HARP, for us, for me personally, it's the model. It's a very good model that anyone can apply to any issue and make an issue a global issue in a relatively short period of time. So I think it's encouraging what's possible now that perhaps wasn't even a decade ago.
Another of the possible effects that Project HARP could have is the generation of seismic effects for the purpose of weaponry, something that will appear to be utter madness to some listeners, yet this is something that was explicitly stated in a treaty between the United States and the former Soviet Union back in the 1970s with regard to environmental modification for military purposes.
Right, that's correct. In fact, even Cohen last April was talking about the idea that earthquake generation was a weapon he called, was in the context of discussion of mass destruction, weapons of mass destruction.
Wasn't this actually, this was, yeah. Excuse me for interrupting, wasn't this actually in April of 97, I believe?
Yeah, you're correct. You're correct. 97 it was in fact. And, you know, when you think about that, you know, that whole idea that our Secretary of Defense would even be postulating that kind of technology being available, but the idea that it is really isn't so far-fetched. I mean, the Earth has a resonant frequency that's been known for some time. If you could create an energy source that oscillated in that frequency, you could set up a resonance capability that might release or trigger an earthquake. And that's the very simple mechanics of geophysical manipulation. Is it possible? Absolutely. I mean, you're talking about a low frequency signal in the 7 to 13 hertz range, which can easily be produced. Just the only question is, how much energy density do you need to trigger such an event? And that's an area that we had Brooks Agnew, a specialist in geophysics in terms of earth-penetrating tomography, even at a few thousand watts, there is a potential of creating an unexpected high-level energy release by just triggering it using this kind of an oscillator, such as HARP.
I want to remind listeners that in April of 1997, William Cohn, what Dr. Begich is talking about, William Cohn, the Secretary of Defense, said basically that terrorist nations were developing the capability of using electromagnetic radiation to cause earthquakes. Anybody with half a brain would recognize that if the Secretary of Defense of the United States will say that at a press conference about terrorist-supporting nations, then it's pretty clear that the United States and other superpowers must have had that technology.
Yeah, because you have to know it, understand it, in order to deduce someone else has the capability themselves. These are what these treaties in the mid-70s were all about, was we realized that, you know, we could do this, the Soviets could do this, and just the idea that anybody would be playing with it was scarier than chemical and biological weapons, because those treaties predate these recent chemical and biological treaties by 20 years. So, I mean, the state of the technology existed, but the same problem when you get into manipulation of weather today existed then, which is the idea that you can't absolutely model the entire system, which is why El Nino can have such a devastating effect on everywhere else in the world. And likewise, regional weather manipulation can have dramatic and dangerous effects as well. And there's even been some speculation that the Super Darn system, which is a system of phased arrays that have been constructed in Canada and now two slated for Alaska, these are the same basic technologies as HARP. They may be used for manipulating magnetic lines of force in such a way as to even trigger these kind of events.
I would point out that your book is subtitled Advances in Tesla Technology, and Nikola Tesla caused a small earthquake using mechanical resonance in New York City in 1896. That was more than 100 years ago. So for listeners who might be dismissing this and saying, well, I'm sorry, Sonny, we're all out of candy, there's nothing funny about this, and it's a matter of public record. Sadly, a record an awful lot of the public either doesn't know about or doesn't want to know about.
Yeah, and that's very true. I think a lot of Tesla research eventually has found its way, you know, into weapons programs. That's why where many of his early concepts, quite frankly, were weapons-related systems. And there wasn't the vision for it, I think, then. And now, even more so now than then, perhaps, people are going back to what these folks that were first studying mechanical and electrical resonances and their effects were actually dealing with. Because in the 20s and 30s, there was a lot of work, not just in this area, but there was also work dealing with using these currents for healing purposes, for all kinds of different purposes. When World War II hit, a lot of this research changed in terms of who was doing it and for what purposes it was being engaged in. And at that point, it really shifted from a civilian research base, moving a lot of interesting directions, to a militaristic research base, both in Europe and in the U.S., that was hidden. Big change in terms of how the science evolved and where it is today.
Dr. Begich, I want to talk about some of the possible, and I shall want to stress in italics the word possible, unintended side effects of this particular system. Why don't we start by developing a little further the interrelatedness of the Earth's of the ecosystem's weather patterns and how altering weather could, in one place deliberately, could unintentionally alter weather someplace else?
Sure. I mean, if you just take into consideration the effects of El Nino in terms of creating drought conditions or creating flooding conditions in the U.S., if you look at the first 11 months of last year, we had more weather-related damage globally related to El Nino than the entire decade of the 1980s. And this is even adjusting for inflation and so on. So your weather-related anomalies are certainly capable of creating huge and widespread damage, even though the center of the event is within a very narrow area.
And I want to point out again that the stated technology or applications of the patent technologies in HAARP specifically talk about altering the weather. Also, we shouldn't necessarily imply that El Nino is a result of Project HAARP, although, you know, who knows? But I don't want the audience to misunderstand
either of
us as saying that that's the case.
No, in fact, one of the things that's interesting is recently even Bernard Eastland was asked by the European Space Agency to prepare a paper utilizing phased arrays, again, this system, for knocking out tornadoes as an example. That's what his paper was essentially about. But again, it's using small systems similar to what HAARP is in terms of what it produces in energy for really manipulating geophysics, and that's the essence of what much of this science was about when it was first being developed.
Dr. Begich, for the remainder of this side, or at least on this side, we'll repeat this again at the end of the next half of the interview. If you could give the address, etc., phone numbers, fax numbers for Earth Pulse Press, where people can get Angels Don't Play This HAARP, Advances in Tesla Technology by yourself and Gene Manning.
Sure. Our website is www.earthpulse.com. And our mailing address is P.O. Box 201393, Anchorage, Alaska, 99520. And we're toll-free also at 888-690-1277.
And the four previous interviews that I've done with Dr. Begich are available from a tape duplication service called Spitfire. That's one word, S-P-I-T-F-I-R-E. They're located at P.O. Box 1179. That's in Ben Lomond, California, capital B-E-N, capital L-O-M-O-N-D, zip code 95005. The email address for Spitfire is spitfire@ix.netcom.com. And there's also a list of and description of the various programs available from Spitfire on the KFJC webpage. That's my home base station, at www.kfjc.org. That's www.kfjc.org. Look in the public affairs section. We've been visiting with Dr. Nick Begich, the author, along with Gene Manning, of Angels Don't Play This HAARP, and subtitled Advances in Tesla Technology, published in softcover by the Earth Pulse Press, copyright 1995. For Nick Begich, this is Dave Emery saying thanks for listening.